All right, y'all, so this has been quite a week. I think you'll agree. And we wonder, maybe, what is this new world we're living in? Or maybe it's us that needs to be renewed. I will resist analyzing too much of the current election and events of the last week in detail because it's not my expertise, and it may not exactly make the best church. But the results of the election have shown me one thing: the need to deepen our faith and our connections with one another. As an elder from the Mormon Church in Fairfax shared at our November 9th post-election call to healing, our future is only as bright as our faith is strong. The last couple of months have reminded us again of the importance of faith, of church, and how they prepare us for what's needed in anything that's difficult: service and sacrifice. Sacrifice coming from the Latin meaning to perform sacred rites or to give up something, to offer something. And this word service, also from the Latin meaning to place oneself at another's behest, to tend to or pay homage, to surrender to a mission. So when we speak of service and sacrifice, we speak of them as blessings of selflessness, of putting our stuff and our desires aside, or better yet, of placing the will of something transcendent or more collective or larger than ourselves squarely into our own hearts, squarely into our own will. Adopting the goals and mission, say, of an institution or a movement, aligning our speech and action to a vision of the common good. This is one of the main activities of church life. But people also do this in many walks of life. They find mission and service and sacrifice in many things they do. And I found this out being a minister here, especially of people who work for our government. They are mission-focused. I am blessed by and loved the public employees at the church I serve, but I cannot help but notice that for many Americans, that public service is often seen with cynicism and suspicion. Despite what some shout, mission and experience matter, as do integrity, inspiration, and telling the truth. Let us first put some things into perspective about what we may have learned on November 8th. So much shock went through many of my friends and colleagues, as well as through my own soul. Why? I think there are many answers. First, I think we seem to have forgotten that our nation hates to grant a third term to a candidate of any party that just had power for 8 years. It's only happened twice in our history before. And somehow our media and our friends and our companions had forgotten that. After 8 years, enough stuff gets dug up. Enemies made, angles of attack formed, people's hopes and needs unfulfilled, that it seems almost natural that the American electorate likes to go for something or someone different than what they just had. I think everyone would agree we have something different. Historical trends show that almost any person who was a Republican should have been the favorite to win this election, no matter what any of the experts and pollsters said. But the USA did not elect just anyone. We did not inaugurate just anyone. We inaugurated a specific someone. Constitutionally, we elected Donald Trump. And no matter what he has said or done, or may be likely to do, He is the President of the United States. More about him in a moment. But in the spirit of faith and humility, we have to remember that for him, we must pray as we do for all presidents. Remembering, as President Obama said the morning after the election and again just last week, that if Trump does well, America succeeds. And for some of us, these might be tough words to hear or to say, all the while knowing that there are some, even among us, who may rejoice. But it is true that I do have grave concerns about our president, but I'm not worried about the fate of our democracy, nor about the American people, most especially not worried about those who voted for him. I am stunned that we elected a man who campaigned on banning Muslims, creating a force to deport immigrants, who suggested cavalierly that we should scrap NATO and allow many other countries to have nuclear weapons, who mocked a disabled reporter, and who brags about being a sexual predator. I guess I had thought we had grown past rewarding that kind of talk and behavior. I guess America is not as mature as I had thought. I am surprised that Trump won, but I am not surprised that Hillary Clinton lost. I found her to be a deeply flawed candidate. But in the near term, I feel certain issues that we have toiled for so long and so hard, issues like racial justice, immigrant compassion, LGBT rights, environmental sanity, women's reproductive freedom, many of these feel threatened. And because of that threat, we have seen so much hand-wringing and anger and near depression among the folks who have a hard time admitting that Trump is president. We saw right after the elections that some had taken to the streets indicating that they would reject the president. And I couldn't help but notice the hypocrisy when just a week before they were shouting loudly that this president better accept the results of the election if he loses. Mostly people have gathered to hold one another, to sing and shout out, and to engage in that good and necessary process of coming together in a show of resistance, as was done yesterday at the Women's March. I was absolutely amazed, not just at the response in Washington. More than 2 million in the United States marched, 3 million around the world. It's an interesting show of people's values. And thank goodness we live in a country where we are allowed to show up publicly and to be upset. All of the reports suggest that the folks who showed up at the marches in the United States yesterday behaved themselves admirably, nothing but high praise for the marchers from police departments around the country. May that please continue. And I have to say that my particular temperament in times of social unrest is to not prefer disruption. I am very Greek in my temperament. I don't like chaos. But I have to remember that my Black, Muslim, Hispanic, female, LGBT friends have taught me that their fear is existential. It's not just a matter of they don't think their policy positions or their values won't be upheld, but that somehow some significant piece of their being will be denied, if not completely rejected and made illegal. They do fear the new normal. They were not prepared for such a moment that seems to repudiate all the progress they had made and all the promise from white liberals suggesting that we were in a new era. So I am left wondering how to respond. I certainly know that I cannot tell those friends of mine whose fear is existential how they should respond to their pain, because that is another form of racism or privilege. What I'm left with is that my Black and Muslim and Hispanic and female and Latino and LGBT friends are the ones we should be allowing to speak and we should be following them. It's important to remember, in the words of Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols, that anger is an energy. Anger is an energy. And energy is value neutral. It's what you do with it. So let us manage our energy to lead us towards transformation and relationship. But let us also be honest with ourselves and resist our worst tendencies to behave like those we might want to call our foes. Trump supporters and opponents were fueled by anger, but we have a difficult history with anger in the religious left. Our churches were founded in response to a vibrant emotionalism that came about in the First Great Awakening, that sweep of what was called the New Light, tent revivals outside the main towns. And because we reacted against that, we ran quickly to what we like to call cold hard reason, pre-wiring ourselves to imagine ourselves as like Vulcans, like Commander Spock. Right? I don't see any pointy ears in this sanctuary. We are emotional beings, but our way of life often denounces emotionality, especially if it's intense. He's so angry, people often will say to discredit someone's truth. I was sharing the souls of black folks as an adult RE program at the congregation I serve, and people were like, he's so angry, I don't know if I can read this. And all I could think of is, if he can't be angry about his people being enslaved and forced into labor and whipped and lynched, what can he be angry about? Anger does not render an argument invalid. And when we ignore the actual events and trends which create that anger, we make the angry feel that we deny their humanity and their experience. We on the left need a deeper emotional maturity. Since November 8th, I have been fighting my anger, but also grief. Indeed, I have never seen my wife, Anya, so sad and upset and angry about political outcomes. You may not know this about my wife, but she started the UUA's Beyond Partisan Division work. She's been telling people in the UUA every way she can, with programming and a film and UUA GA workshops, we need to find a way to welcome political conservatives into our churches. And she has been in a torrent. I know this is in fact because she knows one of the women that Trump allegedly assaulted. She knows that woman for 20 years and has heard that story for a long time. And so her response was, really? This guy? And I have found myself at times simply walking down the street, my eyes watering up and a strange emptiness overcoming me. I'm so unhappy that I did not see this election coming. And this is my own testimony here. How come I place so much of my hopes for what our nation might become in a presidential candidate, in partisan politics? Foolishness. I'm also unhappy that I was unable to discern years ago the very genuine pain, economic struggle, and culture shock so many people from poor white communities live and feel. I knew their struggles intellectually. I heard their cries at my own family reunions and homecomings. I come from a blue-collar electrician background. But somehow, my heart was hardened, and I never let that affect me with the depth that it deserved. I didn't hear or heed the cries of my own people. And I'm not proud of that. Rabbi Michael Lerner shares that people on the left too seldom open themselves to the possibility that there could be a spiritual crisis in a society that plays a role in the lives of many who feel misunderstood and denigrated by fancy intellectualism and radical activists. The left needs to stop ignoring people's genuine inner pain and fear. Yes, the racism, sexism, and xenophobia used by the Trump campaign in his candidacy does not reveal an inherent malice in the majority of Americans. It does not reveal an inherent malice. The left must abandon this shaming of people and listen to those who are angry with compassion and just let them talk. And you've heard this shaming, especially on things like Facebook. Here's just some that I picked up. The uneducated, the uncultured, gun nuts. Why don't they move to where the jobs are? Flyover country, religious wackos, troglodytes. Not sure how that attitude helps anything. I pray we never again claim so many so easily less than. Of course, there is evil. There is racism and classism and misogyny and homophobia. And they may have had some bearing on the campaign, but that's not who those people are. Poor white folks from working class communities have been completely denied legitimacy by our elites, especially the left. So how do we hear this pain? How do we walk with them, assure them they will no longer be left out? How do we provide relief, material, spiritual, vocational, for the injuries of class that the global marketplace will always generate? Due to our privilege of education, culture, position, race, etc., we have fooled ourselves into thinking eventually the rest of the country will evolve and think like us. And we also have fooled ourselves that we live in a meritocracy. We don't live in a meritocracy. Success is as much a matter of who you know, where you live, luck, and playing the game as it has ever been. But we allow ourselves to become blind to our own privilege. Since we claim we live in this meritocracy, we can also claim unequivocally that we deserve the unequal share of the pie that we consume because the system of our making has rewarded us and deemed us a little more worthy. And since those in poorer communities also believe they live in a meritocracy because it's part of the American story, many of them have internalized deep shame. Why? Because they believe the lie that they themselves are less than because they don't have as much as many of us. So we're in a complicated mess. And it's going to take forbearance and discernment and listening to the right voice to figure it out. This week reminded us to check all our assumptions. Just because we find it disqualifying that a presidential candidate uses language that we know is racist, misogynist, anti-immigrant does not mean that everyone feels that disqualifies him. We've learned this, right? Trump voters took him seriously while we took him literally. I don't want this to be our world, but at least right now it is. So we better figure out how to lead and act in the world the way it is, or I should just go back to being an electrician full time. So, it's usually around here that I look in your faces and you're wondering, where's the hope? Here it is. Today we have greater focus for our work. We know more about the world as it really is. We know more we need to come together. It's time for us to be more common sense in our justice work. And please, can we stop beating one another up because we don't have the perfect plan or use the perfect words. Let us seek out and find the voices that we don't normally hear and simply listen, not correct or give them advice. It's time to get out of our comfort zones and practice deep listening. Listen to the poor rural whites, yes, but also listen to the marginalized. And also, like Samuel, listen to that still small voice calling us from wherever we find ourselves to turn ourselves into the best possible person we can be. And we are also called to act as public allies for our Black, gay, female, Muslim, disabled, immigrant neighbors. So I urge you, if you do not have any Black, LGBT, Muslim, immigrant friends, it's time to make some. And times like this, shyness is not an excuse. Right? And once you invite them, let them do the talking. I invite you to go to a mosque, invite a Muslim over for dinner, and make sure you know what he or she can't eat, and don't put any alcohol on the table. Defend dignity and truth. Demand environmental stewardship. We know these things. We know that racism, misogyny, religious hatred, homophobia are real and must be countered, maybe more earnestly than ever. But in that opposition, I call us to never be as nasty or vulgar as our foes, even if we think it'll get more press attention or headlines. Because I've had people at the UUA tell me that's why some of their messaging has been the way it is, because it'll get more headlines. It doesn't work. Our very demeanor is a large part of our social justice witness. We must be vigilant, of course, in case the dog whistles blown during this campaign embolden terror and bring out the nasty. But we must also find ways to stop demonizing people we disagree with, whether it's politically, culturally, or religiously. You guys have seen the nastiness on social media. It is beneath us. So listen deeply and respond to pain from whoever it comes from with genuine compassion, not arguments about public policy. Honor their anger. Think about this response to anger. How many of you are in committed relationships? How many of you, when your partner has been angry, you said, "Oh, honey, please calm down. There's no big deal." How'd that work for you? Everybody's the same. It doesn't work. I hope you all have a really good doghouse to go to if you're like that with your partner, I'm just saying. This election was about many feeling disregarded and genuine cultural and economic pain, not about hatred. Most who voted for Trump don't believe he means or has done the nastier things that he says. And if we don't see this, we will be chasing the wrong phantom and thinking we are pure and righteous in the chase. So the coming time will require nuance, complexity, discernment, restraint, but bold action when it's required. If we know one thing about President Trump, it's that he loves to be loved. Am I wrong? He loves to be loved. So if he does something that we think is good, we better be number one and the loudest out there applauding him. Because you know what? He might be like, "I've never seen those folks applaud me before. Hey, what else do you guys like?" Don't think it's not possible. But of course, if he begins to unleash the darker angels of his vision, then we know we must unite and step forward as protectors of truth, reason, and perhaps even entire groups of Americans. I personally made such a vow at Dar El Hijra Mosque. Dar El Hijra is a member institution of Voice. Some of you may know Imam Jahari. His congregation has been a leader in Voice for years. And I visited them not long after the election. They were having a day of solidarity. And they wanted to have some folks, especially some straight white folk who are almost Christian, as they see us, to come and give some support. So, you know, I was there, so I wore my kufi. I keep one because I'm a little bit of a germaphobe, so I'm not going to take one out of a box and put it on my head. And I went there, and Attorney General Mark Herring was there, and he pledged that no resource for the state of Virginia would be used for mass deportations or to assist the federal government in any way for any Muslim registry. He didn't have to do that. He also was a major player at a Muslim solidarity event at his home church in Leesburg last year. And then when I was done making my remarks, and, you know, being a city boy from Baltimore and having a little bit of Viking blood in me, my sharing was a little more like, you know, I'll stand here as a human shield and fight them with you. You know, it wasn't very much like a Christian pastor might say. And a man came up to me crying and gave me his prayer bracelet. So when a time comes, if it comes, we know what to do. We need to stand with, next to, perhaps in front of. Not all of us can do that particular witness, but enough of us need to be ready to do that. Because in the end, this is only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness will pass, a new day will come, and when the sun shines, it will shine out all the clearer. There is much good in this world, Mr. Frodo, and it is worth fighting for. And it is an honor to be in that struggle with people like you.